Hi, I'm Piper.
And I'm Erin.
Welcome to Off the Tracks podcast, where we explore what it means to do law differently.
Today, we are joined by Erin Zeitz. Erin lives in Ottawa with her husband, 14-year-old twins, and their dog. She has been a lawyer for 18 years and has been working in-house for 12 of those years and has spent 9 of those years working in tech. Erin is currently the chief legal officer at 1Password, a password management security software company, and we are so excited to have her with us.
So, Erin, we are so thrilled you are here today. I have been a longtime social media fan of yours. This is, you know, me admitting this for the first time out loud, and I feel like I should stop admitting this to our guests, but I just have always been so fascinated by the work that you do. And I remember about a year ago, I was like, not sure what I wanted to do with my career, and I was really interested in tech. And I like talked to one of the sourcers at 1Password, and I remember so much spending time like creeping on your LinkedIn. And anyways, all of this to say is we're so happy you're here. So Erin, we always love to dive in and get to know a little bit about how your career has evolved over time, because you have such a cool role at 1Password. And obviously you didn't graduate law school and just get into that role. So can you tell us a little bit about the road that's taking you to where you are today?
Oh gosh, absolutely. Well, thank you. That was very kind of you to say. What a nice introduction. The road that took me to where I am, I'd say it's improbable, but like everyone else, just like one thing led to the next. So I started in big law, submerged an article at a national firm in Ottawa, and then moved to Toronto, practicing securities law, mainly for resource issuers. Did that for about 5.5, 6 years. And then by then, my husband and I had twins who were 2 years old, and candidly, we just needed more family support. My husband also grew up in Ottawa, so the two of us decided that our careers would take a big hit, but that we would, you know, do right by the kids and do right by family and move back home to Ottawa, where my parents and my in-laws are, which was great. That was so much help for the both of us with the kids. So I spent another year at a national firm before following a partner in-house to a health sciences company that was very small, but had divested down and so was still listed on the Toronto Stock Exchange, the New York Stock Exchange. And after about 3 years there, I divested them of another business unit, eventually helped take them private. By then I had met some of the folks at Shopify. As you can imagine, Ottawa is pretty small. And there was already back in, I think I met them in around, I want to say 2012, I met Harley. And you could tell they were building something really special. I had a nascent interest in tech. My dad, who's not a lawyer, worked in tech in Ottawa for many years. In Ottawa, there was always a big tech scene in the 90s when I was sort of going through high school and undergrad. And so it was always fascinating to me. So I just kept in touch. And every couple of months, Harley and I would meet for coffee, and I would sort of, you know, figure out what they were up to and sort of convince them that, hey, one day you folks are going to want to go public and I know how to do that. I can help you out. And finally just convinced them in the fall of 2014 to let me come in-house. Didn't know anything really about working in tech, but you sort of figure it out as you go, and certainly didn't start out being the massive company that it was when I joined. It was smaller, so was able to sort of evolve and scale up with it. After 7.5 years, it was quite a ride. When I left, I was managing a team of about 75 people, which never would have predicted that for my career. Took a little bit of time away just to catch my breath after a wild 7.5 years. And then when the 1Password opportunity came up, it was just way too good to pass up. A great Canadian company where I could stay in Ottawa and work from here. I think after Shopify, you sort of get addicted to the work and the pace and the people in tech. And so I don't know that I could have gone into an in-house gig somewhere else. Like I really was looking for another role in-house at a tech company.
That's so interesting, Erin. And, you know, every law school both now, like if someone's going to law school now, back when you went to law school, like courses have evolved over time and every law school is so different. And something that I've heard repeatedly, and I know that there are some schools looking to change this, but like most law schools don't teach you to run a business or to be a manager. And you just mentioned how by the end of your tenure at Shopify, you were leading a team of 75 people. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about lawyers as managers and lawyers as leaders in that space, because I know that's maybe not what you anticipated when you moved over to Shopify. And then that's how, you know, your role evolved. And I'd love a little bit about how you probably learned on the fly and also what you learned from that experience.
Absolutely. I think to paint us all with a broad brush, lawyers don't typically make great managers, probably because, as you know, like we're not trained as managers, we're not taught to be managers. And, you know, hopefully things have changed a lot since I was in big law, but it certainly didn't seem to be part of the training for the partners either. And so early days, when I started to hire folks, my focus was a lot more on remembering what I hadn't liked about other leaders that I'd worked with and sort of, well, I wasn't going to do that. But I candidly didn't have a ton to look at and say, well, this is someone that I'd like to emulate in their leadership style. So it was a lot more of what not to do than what to do. Luckily, you know, at a fast growing startup like Shopify, I definitely was not the only first-time leader. And so the company really invested a lot in books, in training, in coaches. I always had a coach. At a lot of companies, coaches for execs is a punishment. It's what you get when you misbehave or things aren't going well. But at Shopify, it was a perk, and it was the best perk by far. And we had a lot of good perks. So having a coach was just fantastic, and just being really intentional about it. You know, I think as lawyers, we're so used to studying things. And, you know, if you need to learn a new thing, you just dive deep and just read up on it, talk to people, you know, go all in. And for me, leadership management was no different. And so I just focused really hard on initially kind of golden rule, treating people the way I wanted to be treated, and then realizing that that actually wasn't the right way to do it. And it was platinum rule, teaching people how they wanted to be treated and that people were different and needed different styles. Truthfully, being a parent, I think, really informs my management, and probably my lawyering and management informs my being a parent. Just taught me a lot more about patience and, you know, how to have difficult conversations, how to work with people when they're not at their best, or maybe I'm not at my best. So I think management is the work of a lifetime. I don't think I'll ever be exactly the manager that I want to be, but it's something that I've worked really hard at and feel like I've gotten good at, and something that I try to improve on, you know, every day that I show up to work.
Yeah. And one thing that you touched on is that whole coaching piece. And I don't know, maybe you could talk a bit about this, but how did you find coaching through that sort of role differ than like the traditional mentorship relationship that, you know, you get through the more traditional law firm atmosphere? I don't know if there is a difference. Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. I don't know if you've kept up with sort of coaching in your personal professional life as well. Maybe just speak a bit about your coaching experience too. That'd be just interesting to hear.
Yeah, the coaches I've had, and I do have another coach now at One Password. And again, it's the best perk. I really highly recommend it if you can swing it. The coaches that I work with are not lawyers. And so I think it's definitely a different perspective. I think it's much more focused on just quote unquote the business and how business folks work together. Because when you work in-house, you are part of the business. You are the business. And so it's much more focused on the dynamics of the business and just the dynamics of people, which I think for the most part is the same across any function. I mean, I think there's definitely specificities and peculiarities of lawyers that You're raising a good point. It might be interesting to talk to sort of a coach who is a lawyer or who was a lawyer. But I mean, I definitely have so many friends that work in-house, that still work in firms. And so a lot of what we talk about is the people that we work with and work for and that work for us. So I think more the learning and development that I get is more from peers, I'd say. I don't know that I've had a legal mentor that springs to mind, but I've been very blessed in having amazing peer mentors and peer support of the folks that I sort of came up with. And we were struggling with similar things or different things. Also, of course, the women in Backbone that I met at Shopify and other folks that I met at Shopify who were and are still amazing leaders have been a great resource for me to, you know, chat through how they've dealt with different things, the challenges they've faced. And so I think you can learn a lot from anyone. So I certainly tried to take from my peers who are lawyers as much as I can, but also learn as much as I can from folks that aren't lawyers, because I think, again, lawyers don't always make the best leaders, if I'm being quite honest.
Okay, Erin, we love this. And this is such a good point, because I think sometimes, you know, in the legal profession, we always have, especially in the regular firm structure, lawyers as leaders. And I love sort of what you're talking about of looking outside of that and looking at alternatives and bringing in people with different perspectives as well to help inform those lawyers who take on the leadership roles. And I think that that's so important. And I also think it's so important to, as you've expressed, like when you were at Shopify and you had the coaching and now 1Password, it's not a punishment. It's like curiosity of how you can always be doing better and learning new things and seeing things from different vantage points. We want to dive in and talk about Backbone Angels, but before we do, I just have one sort of final question to sort of tie together the two really big organizations you've worked for in tech. And something, you know, that's really neat in tech and in our evolving workplace structures out in the world is different titles. And so, you know, you've had many different titles at Shopify, including general counsel, corporate secretary, and now at 1Password, you're the chief legal officer. Erin, what do those things mean? Do you mind just like giving us a bit of, you know, what just like straight up, what do those things mean? What is the difference? And what kind of do your role have your roles encompassed as you've worked in tech?
Oh gosh. Well, I think you gave me a promotion. I definitely never had a GC title at Shopify. I think I was assistant general counsel.
Yes.
I think until I left, I don't think I had an associate general counsel title. I think I was assistant general counsel and corporate secretary towards the end. So for me, general counsel is sort of the lead lawyer that works in-house. But I think, and I'm no expert, but I think because often the general counsel is hopefully part of the executive leadership team, and those folks tend to have fancy C-level titles. So I think that's what might have, you know, influence the move towards the CLO title, which is the title I have now, Chief Legal Officer, which I think makes sense, you know, if I'm sitting at a table or, you know, out in the world with my Chief Financial Officer colleagues, you know, my Chief Product Officer colleagues, it would make sense that I would want to have a Chief Legal Officer title, just to be very clear of where I sit and the influence that I hope to have. You know, with the CEO, my boss, and with the executive team. I think I always kind of wonder what people think about these different titles or if they know what it means. Like, I remember when I took this job, my husband being very concerned about why I didn't have a GC title. And I was like, well, I got a CLO title. That's better. And he's like, no, it isn't. So honestly, I don't know. I think, look, titles do matter. So I think it's important. I don't think I would have not taken the job if they'd said, we want to call you general counsel instead of chief legal officer. I think what mattered more to me was where I sat and who I reported to. So I guess to answer your question, it's tough for me to say. I know, especially in house, it seems like sometimes inflated titles are given instead of salary bumps. And what I tend to caution folks about, if I'm speaking to people that are working their way up, maybe asking for advice, titles are important, but you can't put those into an RSP or an RESP, put your kid through college on them. So definitely titles are important, but I think more important is to advocate for proper compensation. And more importantly than titles, I think would be the story that you would tell to the next recruiter of, you know, here's what my title was, but here's who I reported to, here's who my peers were, here's who I work with. And, you know, this is the impact that I had in my organization. So I think you can explain around an awkward title if for whatever reason your organization has a different structure than, you know, you think your peers have. I think they're important, but I don't think they're the be all end all. It's certainly something that I advocate for my team to get them the proper titles, but also the proper compensation.
Ooh, that is excellent advice. I really think that that is a good way to frame it and good way to think about it. And I love the idea that, yeah, titles are very important, but you can't put them towards your student debt. That's for sure. But the next question we have for you is that we know you are one of the founding partners of Backbone Angels. Can you tell us a bit more about this venture and how it has evolved over time?
Yeah, absolutely. Another very improbable part of my story. I remember in law school learning about angel investing and just thinking like, oh, maybe one day I'll get to help other people angel invest. It definitely never crossed my mind that one day I would be the one signing, you know, that check and that agreement.
Erin, for anyone who, you know, maybe doesn't know the full definition of angel investing, can you share that with some people who might be listening?
Oh gosh, I don't even know if I'm qualified to define it. But so in sort of the ecosystem of getting a startup off the ground into, you know, the life cycle of where you hope to take a company through, typically folks start, you know, themselves with a nest egg or savings or a line of credit. Maybe they'll do a friends and family round. Which is typically where Backbone would come in, and we can talk about that and raise some capital that way. And that's sort of the angel ecosystem where then you start to go out to folks, you know, lawyers and doctors, people with capital that can afford to invest in you. And then you start, the VCs start to come in when you get to sort of Series A or Series B and write progressively bigger and bigger checks until hopefully one day, you know, you either get bought or take your company public and raise capital that way. So in the whole ecosystem, angels come in sort of earlier and sort of write smaller checks. Certainly I do write smaller checks than VCs. And for Backbone, I mean, I can only speak for myself, but I think for most of us or for all of us in Backbone, we're not looking to lose money. We're trying to make smart investments, but it's not really about making money. I think, you know, we were all incredibly, incredibly lucky at Shopify, and the experience that we gained, and very candidly, the capital that we gained has allowed us to do this amazing thing, which is find entrepreneurs that we want to be able to support through our networks, through our experience, through advice, and support by writing checks and giving early startup capital. You know, when you do that very early friends and family round, you have to have friends and family that can write checks, and not everybody has that. And it doesn't mean that someone doesn't have a great idea or what it takes to succeed. It just means that maybe they don't have friends and family that can introduce them to the right kind of people that they need to be successful in their venture, or give them the capital that they need to get something off the ground. And so we try to fill that gap and breathe friends and family for women, for non-binary entrepreneurs that might not have that type of network. So it's extremely, extremely fulfilling to be able to write a check to support a venture that you really want to see succeed and that you think should succeed and sort of level that playing field.
That's so interesting, Erin. And earlier today, when I was on the Backbone website and looking at all of the incredible companies that you and your team have backed. First of all, I many an abandoned cart today on those websites from specifically. But second of all, there is a company on here that I know Erin and I have talked to each other a lot about. We both own Sheer Text Heights. And it's funny, I'm going out for dinner with a friend tonight and we are going to like a prohibition type speakeasy where you have to get like very dressed up. And so I literally like pulled my Sheer Text tights out from my drawer earlier and slammed them on my bed. I was like, these are breaking out the tights tonight. Like I have to get all dressed up. So yeah, no, that's so interesting. And I think it's so important too, like when you talk about supporting entrepreneurs who have these amazing ideas, but might just not have the community behind them who are able to write the checks. I think that that's so crucial. And I think that it's such, like, you've really demonstrated, you know, paying it forward and paying it forward in a way that not, to be frank, like not everyone would probably think to do. And you've created this, like, for lack of a better word, like army and community of people who share the same values. And I think it's so amazing. And yeah, I just think that this, I'm just like so floored. I think it's so cool. And I think it's so badass. And I think it's really like, it shakes up the way to view like business and investing, because really you're investing in people as well as, you know, hopefully making some of that capital back, but like you're really investing in people and great ideas.
It's been so fulfilling. And I mean, I think things are changing. I think things have changed, but we still do hear horror stories about, you know, angel investors who just don't get certain ideas, particularly if they're aimed at women, and they just don't understand or appreciate or are able to value those ideas. And sometimes even, I mean, I think a lot about this, but angel investing is so highly speculative, right? And sometimes there'll be financial projections and people can run models, but the reality is it's so early stage that they're made up, right? You're really betting on the founder or founders, and do they have what it takes? They're probably going to pivot a couple of times. It's not going to be exactly the idea that they're pitching you in that meeting. And so what angel investors do essentially, I think, is pattern match. And they sort of think who are the entrepreneurs that have been successful? And do I see this same hustle in this entrepreneur? Is this person going to make me back my investment? And I have this theory that hustle presents differently in men than in women or people of color. And so sometimes I wonder if you don't know what hustle looks like in someone that is more like you, if you'll miss it. And so some of the, like, again, I'm not doing this to lose money. So the female, you know, founders that I've backed, I see that hustle, right? And I see that something that I think, no, this person is going to make something of the money that I'm giving them. And I do think I'm going to see this back. And sometimes I wonder if it's easy to overlook that, if it doesn't present in the traditional way that we've come to associate with tech founders, because it does show up differently in someone who's a person of color, in a woman, right? And so I think sometimes like recognizes like.
Oh my gosh. So, okay. Every time we record a podcast episode, I completely expose such ridiculous, silly aspects of my life. But one of my favorite things is watching clips, like segments of Dragon's Den or Shark Tank when I'm like getting ready in the morning or like when I'm cooking. I just like plays on YouTube on a loop. When I log into YouTube, it's like my whole page is just suggestions of either Broadway musical clips to watch or Shark Tank or Dragon's Den. And I think you're so right. Like, I think the ways in which people of various different backgrounds who have experienced the world from different vantage points by than people who are, you know, the stereotypical entrepreneur of like white, middle class, upper class white men, they present, you know, how they've come across like the world in different ways. And there have been many an episode of Shark Tank and Dragon's Den where the entrepreneur gets chastised because they haven't quit their full-time job yet. And that's not like a luxury that everyone can afford when building an idea from the ground up. And my whole point of this is I wonder like how we could do like a backbone angels, like Dragon's Den or Shark Tank, you know, like on like a bit of a smaller scale. We have like like we could come up with a cool name. It could be like a mini series, like on YouTube. Maybe it wouldn't be like network, but it would just be so cool and would give people the opportunity to, you know, get in front of people who understand. And I think that it's so cool that you guys have made this space for so many incredible female and non-binary founders.
Oh, I'm going to have to pitch that because I mean, the Backbone Women are hilarious. That would be a very entertaining show. I'm thinking whenever we get together on screen or in person, yeah, it would definitely be very entertaining, but I think you're right. And I mean, look, there's a reason why so many founders are young men, because it is hard to take that chance. As soon as you have dependents, you know, people that depend on you, you can't quit your job and mortgage everything and max out your line of credit and your credit cards. You really can't do that. But at the same time, I mean, if you want something done, give it to a working mom. She will get it done in time to get home for dinner, right? So I think, you know, going back to what we were talking about earlier, and feel free to edit this out, but one of the reasons why I'm so comfortable investing in founders that don't look like, show up like the stereotypical founder is because, again, going back to what we were talking about earlier, when I reached a point in my career where I started to become a manager, a leader, I just became the best leader that I could be that was authentic to who I was, instead of becoming what I thought a leader was supposed to look like or act like, mostly because it was just too difficult to do it any other way. And I think for me, it's been really effective. And so when I think about my career and how, you know, on my best days as a leader, it's because I am being completely authentic to who I am and doing it in a way that feels right for me and not pretending to be something or someone that I'm not. I think an entrepreneur is going to be the most successful when she is being authentic to who she is and not pretending to be some Valley tech bro stereotype.
Ooh, yeah, that is so true. I really like that. That's a good point as well. And also, I think that this show would be great, just, you know, coming back to this show idea, because then everyone would find out about these really cool products and services and all these really cool companies that you guys invest in. Because, yeah, a lot of the things on your portfolio list are things that we have personally bought. I am a huge fan of a good matcha latte in the summer from Bloom. So also saw that too. Oh my gosh,
I have a cupboard full of their lattes.
Oh, I can imagine. I was going to say, and I have been eyeing Fable plates for like ever. I think that it's Fable plates, right?
Yes. Yeah. So we don't all invest in, and so I actually tend to shy away from DTC, but definitely others in Backbone are in Bloom or in Fable for sure. And Sheer Tags. So
cool. Yeah.
yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So cool. So cool. And so we love now that you are, you know, in this position where you're able to back really cool companies and do these cool sorts of projects. But kind of looking back, what has been one of the most significant setbacks that you've faced in your career, and how have you learned from it?
I have had a very, very blessed and lucky career. I'm probably inviting, you know, karma or something horrible by saying this. My biggest setback was at the beginning, which is that I failed to launch. I got a summer and article position in Ottawa. The corporate partner that hired me left midway through. It was a national firm, but the Ottawa office was very small, and they didn't need me, so they didn't hire me back. And so I was unemployed. Like, I did not start my legal career when I was supposed to start as a first year, didn't have a job. And for 6 months, didn't have a job, which was terrifying. You know, I was very privileged. I wasn't terrified on the level of there was food on the table and a roof over my head, but terrified that I had worked so hard to have a career that I wasn't going to have. And my mom, who was so supportive, I mean, both my parents are, she kept saying, like, well, if you can't get a job at a big firm, just start at a small firm and work your way up. And I was like, it doesn't work like that. Like, that's just not how this system seems to work. And I remember thinking at a certain point that if I couldn't get a job in big law, that I was going to have to do that. I mean, I couldn't afford to not work. You know, I just spent all this money on law school, but I was really trying to break into, you know, big law and start my career there, and didn't have any illusions that I was going to stay in big law forever, but sort of had the plan that I would put in a couple of years and then figure out from there. And I just couldn't get my foot in the door to get started. I was super, super lucky in that the firm where I had articled, it was 2005, and it was just super, super busy, and they always ran lean. And so they just had really too much work. And so I think they called me on a Tuesday or Wednesday, and I started on the Thursday at the firm. Like, you know, they called and I said, oh, do you want me to come in for an interview? They're like, no, no, we need you to start work. Like, please come in. And so I was just very, very lucky. I think what it taught me the most was I spent years at that firm just assuming that I wasn't as good or as smart as the rest of the first year class, because, you know, they had all summered an article together, been hired back. And I sort of always felt like I was last choice, desperate choice, that they really needed me. And it wasn't until years after I left that I realized I was very good. I was very good at what I did at that firm. The work that I did was excellent. I mean, now I retain counsel all the time. I was very good at what I did. They were lucky to have me, but I just couldn't see that in myself, because I just always had this feeling that I was there by luck, which I was, but also earned my place and deserved my place, which was, I just couldn't see that at the time.
I think we all have moments in our life where we feel inadequate, or we feel behind, or we feel like undeserving. And it is so hard to shake that feeling, even when maybe in other moments, logically, you know that those feelings aren't what's actually happening. And so it's so interesting to hear you describe yourself experiencing similar feelings, and then being able to look back on it now with very different perspectives and see just how valuable you were at the firm. I think it's so interesting because I meet so many young lawyers now who are experiencing that quote failure to launch. It's so hard for new associates to get to, for first year associates especially, to get roles. And there's such a, like, so many amazing candidates, and there are so few roles in the current legal market. And so for anyone who might be listening who's in that scenario, know that there are, like, you just need one yes. Like, you just need one opportunity to come your way. You need, like, one yes to help you propel you to the next step. And I mean, Erin is a perfect example of that.
100%. Totally agree. And I, like, when I look back, like, I understand why I didn't do well in OCIs. Like, I didn't know how to show up in those interviews and be what they were looking for. They were pattern matching too, and I didn't fit the pattern. And again, like, that's on them, not on me. I was very good at the job, but I almost didn't squeak in the door because I just didn't know how to play the game, candidly.
And it's definitely a game. And I mean, any long legal career involves a little bit of playing some sort of game at some point. And so in that same vein, Erin, how do you take care of your mental health, and how have you taken care of your mental health as your career has evolved?
Oh, such a good question. I think building up resilience and grit has been the most important thing, because then the stress just doesn't wear you down as much, and you just don't experience as much stress. So, like, I hear your question, like, you definitely still have to take care of your mental health. But when I think back to those early years at the firm, you know, the most pervasive memory that I have is just having a stomach ache all the time. And I don't have that anymore. I mean, you definitely have your days or your moments, but I think the biggest thing is focusing on trying to develop as much ease as you can in your day-to-day practice and recognizing that the stress that we have, the pressure that we're under, that's the privilege of the gig. It's something you get to do and not something that you have to do. You know, I could have a job. I always say this about myself, but I really believe it. You know, if I quit law and became a barista, I think I would be just as stressed because I would see a line growing. I would worry that the last drink I made wasn't that good. I could do better. You know, like I think it's just in my nature to want to do a good job and please people and be the best that I can be at whatever I'm doing. And so I think I would feel the same level of stress, you know, whether I'm a lawyer or whether I'm, you know, making lattes. And so for me, it's like, well, I like being a lawyer and the type of work that I want to do tends to come with pressure. And so I try to reframe the pressure as something that it's just sort of the price of admission to do the work that I want to do. In terms of trying to answer your actual question, I mean, definitely the people that I love. My partner, my husband is amazing. I know that he's there for me and I can go to him whenever I need a sounding board or sympathetic ear. Once I had my kids, you know, you always worry, am I going to be able to balance work and family? But one of the unexpected blessings of being a working mom is they gave me just so much perspective and they made the work stress so much easier to bear because, you know, didn't matter how hard a day I was having or how stressed I was, if my kids were okay, it really couldn't be that bad. And it just brought everything into perspective. So I think for me, that's the biggest thing. And then all the other things that, you know, would be the things that we know are obvious, but we don't always do, trying to make time to eat right, to drink a lot of water, exercise, make time for friends and things that make me happy. You know, it's a balance one day at a time.
That is a really great perspective. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. And we have so enjoyed listening and learning from you today. It really has been the highlight of our day. So we love to end the podcast with the same question, which is, what is something new that you've learned recently?
Oh gosh, that is a good question. And I do try to always keep learning. I think with joining 1Password, you know, being in tech, I've learned a lot about encryption and double-ended encryption, definitely more than I ever knew before. I think that's one of the best perks of the job is that it's my job to get to pick the brains of really, really smart developers and engineers and have them explain to me the ins and outs of what we do so that I can do my job. And so lately I've been digging in on that.
That's amazing. It's funny. I actually bought 1Password back in December and nice. Yes. And so I have definitely been continuing to play around with it and figure out, you know, how to maximize how I best use it. But it's such a neat concept. And I know that the organization is just continuing to grow. And so, Erin, this has been so illuminating. And we are so grateful that you've shared all of the many perspectives, like, and so many areas that your career has spanned with us today. We just really appreciate you taking the time. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, of course. Thank you. This was really fun.
Thanks for joining us for this episode. To stay up to date with the podcast, follow us on Instagram at Off the Tracks Podcast. Be sure to subscribe on your favorite listening platform for a brand new episode of Off the Tracks Podcast every Tuesday.